With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us today on the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, acreage of stone fruit production in California is decreasing. We'll have more. And some hydrogels to manage ants are showing promise in grapevines. But our top story today, a proposed Northern California anti-ag measure could have an effect nationwide. The measure in Sonoma County would eliminate animal agriculture in that county. Director of Political Affairs with the California Farm Bureau, Stephen Fenaroli, says it would affect many farms.
It would outlaw, you know, all animal agriculture in the county. And so, you know, that would affect dairies, that would affect poultry operations.
Two of the biggest animal ag industries in the county. The measure titled Prohibition on Concentrated Animal Feeding Operations is backed by an animal rights extremist group, which has already collected more than 18,000 signatures toward putting the measure on the ballot. It has until March to collect the remaining 2,000 verified signatures needed. The trajectory shows it will go to the voters, and Fenaroli says that's something that the agriculture industry around the nation should keep a watchful eye on.
A lot of the country, you know, I think begrudgingly looks to California and they kind of say, oh gosh, you know, California, what are they doing now? But I think this is just this thing has national implications, right? If a group can qualify a measure and they can outlaw animal agriculture in a county, that sets up a recipe for them to, a playbook for them to repeat that not only throughout the state, but throughout the country.
Fenaroli says when political attacks like this come up, it's important for the animal ag industry to gather the troops and fight back.
And I do think that we're kind of seeing that right now. You go to the Sonoma County issue about animal ag, and, you know, that is, you know, that has a lot of implications. And I think that, you know, we saw kind of from the, you know, the results of Prop 12 and, you know, some of the pork stuff that, you know, there were some times where, you know, we weren't as active as I think we could be. And I say we as kind of just all of ag. And so, you know, how are we going to mobilize and how are we going to have a voice?
Fenaroli encourages farmers around the country to speak up because California is often a starting point for anti-ag movements that spread around the nation. The regulatory battles are never truly over for the U.S. cattle industry, but there have been victories over the years. Ethan Lane, Senior Vice President of Government Affairs with the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, says 2023 saw a victory in the Waters of the U.S. battle.
There's no question that the current regulation that was put forward and then changed after that Supreme Court ruling is a win for the cattle industry and for farmers by any measure. It eliminates 65% of the potential waters or, you know, sandy bottom washes or prairie potholes that would have been included in that original rule are now not included or exempt given that new definition or that new structure. But the way they crafted that rule, they failed to define a lot of the important terms in there. You know, that federal nexus component is still a little bit open-ended. That litigation piece is going to continue in an effort to make sure that that refinement happens.
They are hopeful for a solid final rule to be in place during the next few months. However, other battles continue, including one regarding the Endangered Species Act.
You know, this is something that comes back over and over and over again. I mean, you have a broken Endangered Species Act, but an agency in charge of it that refuses to recognize that it's broken. If you had a car with tires that were slashed and you were running on the rims, you would pull over and fix the tire. Almost 50 years into the Endangered Species Act, there's no interest at Fish and Wildlife in fixing the tire. They're just going to keep running on the rim. And we're seeing that in how they're implementing it with the lesser prairie chicken and this sort of rusty lawn chair split management approach. And there's a 40 in the north and an endangered listing in the south. It's an incredibly poorly written rule.
A court fight over the lesser prairie chicken is just one of the ongoing ESA battles.
We're in court on that one as well with some other stakeholders. We're seeing challenges like that out west. They're trying to reintroduce the grizzly bear to the North Cascades ecosystem in Washington State. We're continuing to fight the gray wolf. The Endangered Species Act is still one of the biggest Achilles heel problems of the cattle industry nationwide.
Don't forget, if you have missed any of our morning shows, or if you just need to catch the news at a different time, you can subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet News Hour on your favorite podcast downloading app. This is the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halvorsen, and we will return in just a moment. You're listening to the AgNet News Hour. In today's National Spotlight, I spoke recently with Risk Management Agency Administrator Marcia Bunger about some important programs with deadlines coming right up. Here is our conversation.
All right,
Well, let's talk about what's going on right now, and there are some deadlines for programs that are coming up. Is that correct?
That is very correct. So PRF, the Pasture Rangeland Forage Policy, that deadline is December 1st. So I would say don't just walk, but run to your crop insurance agent so that you can have a discussion if that's something that you're interested in for your livestock operation. It is a weather index policy, so you're not in. So part of it is that you don't involve a crop adjuster. We use NOAA data to determine whether your area hasn't experienced a loss, and so there's no claims adjuster that comes out. We're notified through our companies, through NOAA, whether it triggers, and then a claim payment is paid out. And so, again, December 1, so don't miss that deadline. In addition, we are going to be hosting a livestock roadshow this winter. We are hitting several locations throughout the country. Livestock products have basically exploded. I believe now the livestock revenue protection policy is in the top 10 of all of the policies that we sell, and that will be covered. In addition, we just rolled out a pilot for weaned calf. That is going to be available in South Dakota, Nebraska, Colorado, Texas, and I might be missing one other state, but all of that information is available on the website. And that deadline is January for that weaned calf. So again, while you're talking about PRF to your agent, also have them take a look and talk about the weaned calf if you're in that pilot area.
So going back to the PRF, the idea of having it go through NOAA notifications, not having to have a claims adjuster come out, that sounds like a really streamlined process.
It is very streamlined, and I can speak to that one personally, first as a former crop insurance agent, but also as a user of that particular policy. So the process is that your agent fills out an application with you. You identify the pastures, the hay ground that you want to insure. The agent will go through the different quotes because there is different levels that you can purchase. And then once that is locked in and you have locked in your intervals that you want covered, then you basically kind of go about your business. And as the year progresses, then if the data shows that a payment has triggered, then your agent will get a hold of you and say, hey, you know, we have a payment for you.
So the most difficult thing a producer has to do to be part of this is make sure that they beat that deadline of December 1st to sign up.
Bingo. Exactly. So again, don't just walk, but run.
Anything else you think our listeners should know about, or have we covered?
I think we've covered, you know, a lot. You know, I know you cover just a huge area. So there are a number of announcements that we have recently made. Improvements. We've added enterprise unit to several crops that was never available before. We've also added shellfish as a covered product in some parts of the country. So if you are an aquaculture producer, again, I would say get a hold of a crop insurance agent. The thing that I think I continue to remind farmers, and my husband and I are farmers, is that crop insurance isn't just about weather events. It's also a tool to be able to market and enhance your operation.
You know, being a farmer yourself, does that give you a different perspective as you are taking care of all of these programs?
Oh, definitely, because, you know, many times if you're not a farmer, I think it's hard to understand what the farmer's going through. He's busy. I mean, there's so few of us anymore across the country doing work to feed the world, basically. And so it's important that those of us in any industry, that we make sure that we are explaining, taking the time to explain it in a way that it's understandable.
Thank you so much for your time, and thank you for being here at Trade Talk today.
Thank you so much. Have a good day.
That's today's National Spotlight. Now here's Randall Wiseman with today's Livestock Report.
Well, in today's livestock news, even though pork and broiler production is expected to increase next year, total meat output will decline. That's all due to a cutback in beef production. Gary Crawford has more details.
The numbers of cattle, especially heifers, being sent to slaughter or to feedlots have continued to increase over the last few months. And one analyst says, of course,
higher cow slaughter and higher placements now, it just means that even further down the line, it's going to continue to tighten up supplies.
So much so that for 2024, USDA Outlook Board Chairman Mark Chekanowski says,
what we are expecting to see for the coming year is a fairly sharp reduction year over year in beef production, so down about 1 billion pounds.
Or about a 4% decline in production at 25.8 billion pounds. And that, of course, is likely to bring on what Mark calls
really very historically high steer prices.
USDA currently projecting steer prices next year to average almost $185 a hundredweight. That would be up 4% from the already high prices we've been seeing this year. Consumer beef prices are already running about 9% higher than a year ago. Meanwhile, the situation for the pork industry, that's a little different. Over the last few months for hog producers,
prices have been relatively soft.
So there hasn't been a lot of incentive to boost pork production very much in 2024. Mark Jeganowski thinks next year's pork output will be what he calls
relatively flat. I mean, up just a bit, up about 500 million pounds year over year.
Or a little less than a 2% increase at 27.7 billion pounds. Now, as far as hog prices go for next year,
we're anticipating some growth,
but not as much as was being forecast even a month ago.
Just because we're not quite seeing the level of demand that we had anticipated.
So the new forecast for average hog prices next year?
$60.25 per hundredweight. That would be up about $1.30 per hundredweight year over year.
Or about a 2% increase from this year's average hog price. Meanwhile, consumer pork prices are running below last year by a little over 1%, but next year they could edge up by an average of about 2%. Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Thanks, Gary. And a quick reminder, the 107th Annual California Cattlemen's and Cattlewomen's Convention is coming up this week. It'll be held November 29th through December 1st at the Nugget Casino in Reno. Now, confirmed speakers for this year's event include Patrick Linnell with Cattle Facts, Michelle Miller, the Farm Babe, and Emily Ellis with the Animal Ag Alliance. If you'd like to see a full schedule and learn more about registration, simply go to the California Cattlemen's Association website, calcattlemen.org. That's calcattlemen.org. But that event kicks off November 29th. I'm Randall Wiseman for AgNet West.
This is the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will return in just a moment with more agriculture news. Coming up in a few moments, we'll have today's This Land of Ours report, but first, more of the day's agriculture news. And with today's AgNet West headlines, here's Brian German.
The California stone fruit industry has been undergoing some changes over the past few years. Director of Government and Public Policy for the California Fresh Fruit Association, Adam Borchardt, explained how the industry has been shifting recently.
An ongoing trend with stone fruit production in California, we're seeing decreasing acreage of stone fruit production, and then particularly among shipping companies, a consolidation within the industry. One thing to highlight is now about 10 shippers handle about 90% of the total volume of stone fruit in California. There are a number of factors involved, both market-based factors and regulatory pressures. And I also would be remiss to say California is the number one stone fruit state in the country. So about 70% of our stone fruit production in the United States originates in California.
Gowan Milling, a subsidiary of Gowan Group, has expanded its manufacturing capacity by acquiring a Winfield United facility in Blytheville, Arkansas. The facility, now named Gowan Milling Blytheville and led by Mike Callahan, general manager, enhances proximity to key markets, emphasizing safety, quality, and flexibility. Offering diverse capabilities, including herbicide pan granulation, the facility strengthens Gowan's commitment to meeting customer needs on a larger scale. Benefits include a centralized location in Blytheville for efficient U.S. service and increased manufacturing capacity to meet growing demand. Gowan Milling plans substantial investments in the facility, focusing on expanded capabilities and cutting-edge technologies. Callahan expressed enthusiasm for the strategic acquisition, highlighting its role in delivering crop protection chemicals, expanding product offerings, and improving overall service. The USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service has initiated the 2023 Irrigation and Water Management Survey. Survey codes have been mailed out to selected irrigators nationwide, encouraging online responses to compile a comprehensive data set on irrigation activities and water use in American farms, ranches, and horticultural operations. The survey, linked to the 2022 Census of Agriculture, aims to support the USDA's promotion of efficient irrigation practices and long-term sustainability of water resources. The deadline for all responses, either through the online respondent portal or paper questionnaires, is February 15th. NAS Administrator Hubert Hamer emphasizes the survey's influence on policy decisions crucial for the agricultural industry's future. Results from the survey will be made available in November 2024. Researchers are looking to solve biological control issues for pests that produce honeydew. UC Cooperative Extension Entomology and Pest Management Advisor David Havlin said hydrogel technology is showing promise in vineyards.
Ants come and drink that honeydew as food. Therefore, they make sure that those mealybugs don't get eaten by predators and parasitoids. Because of that disruption that the ants cause, biocontrol is not as potential. So we're trying to kill the ants to increase biocontrol, to reduce the pests, and therefore use less pesticides. The hydrogels is just one new, very creative way to do that, where we're taking a substance that absorbs a lot of water and we're putting sugar water into it. So we're imitating the honeydew with a very just ultra low amount of pesticide. Then we apply it to the fields. The ants come and drink it. Once they get back to the colony, they feed it to their babies and to the queen. And eventually the colony dies and collapses. So a very safe way to control the ants and accomplish the goals.
UC Agriculture and Natural Resources is hosting the 2024 Statewide Pistachio Day in January in Visalia. The event provides information about the latest research-based production practices to prospective or current growers, production managers, and pest control consultants. This year's event is scheduled for January 17th at the Visalia Convention Center. The morning will start off with an update from the California Pistachio Research Board, followed by a presentation on the economics of pistachio production and an update on research being supported by the Specialty Crops Research Initiative. After lunch, there will be information about foliar diseases, plant parasitic nematodes, and Gill's mealybug. The final presentation will cover recommendations for a California response to the new Carpophilus beetle. More information about the 2024 Statewide Pistachio Day is available on the upcoming events page at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for Agnet West Radio Network.
In other news, the nation's corn harvest continues to progress. USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey gives us details.
The slowest state as of November 19th is Michigan. So despite that good progress, they advanced only from 52 to 67% harvested. And even there, that is behind the five-year average of 75%. Other states that are appreciably behind their five-year average pace, Pennsylvania, 70% harvested versus 80%. And then just marginally behind in Ohio, 81 versus 83%. And I will point out that even though we haven't hit the 90% mark harvested in Wisconsin and North Dakota, those numbers are actually ahead of the respective five-year averages, which just means that in some of those northern states, we've had pretty open weather to this point, and the corn is coming out faster than usual.
This is the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will return in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Grower.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. Does sleep affect our health and safety? Well, to find out, just try to stay awake for this report from Gary Crawford.
And now, classic tippler and comedian W.C. Fields on today's subject.
Sleep.
Sleep.
The most beautiful experience in life. Except drink.
Well, let's throw that last part out, but Fields was right about sleep. The experts agree on the importance of it.
Sleep rules everything in our life.
Oh, sleep rules. That's Susan Harris. She's a nurse and sleep expert with University of Nebraska Extension, and she has spent much of her career studying sleep, educating, and advising people about it.
This is my passion topic, and I'm always happy to talk about sleep and sleeplessness.
And when she says...
sleep rules everything in our life.
She means it.
It controls us physically, emotionally, socially, behaviorally, nutritionally, cognitively, everything you can imagine.
In other words,
sleep is like this overnight cleaning crew.
Hey, make it snappy, you guys. We've got three more offices to clean. Get busy.
Oh, a cleaning crew, yes.
That goes into your brain and cleans it out, and then it heads down into the basement and it repairs your organs and your muscles and rejuvenates them.
and it does it much more quietly than our demonstration cleaning crew there. But seriously, Susan Harris says sleep renews our bodies, and in the opinion of her and many experts,
sleep is the most underestimated and underutilized health aid in our modern society. Absolutely.
Harris says if everybody knew just some of the life-enhancing properties of sleep, they would not underestimate it. What if you saw this ad for a special product as you were sitting up at 1 in the morning eating ice cream and cookies?
Scientists have discovered a revolutionary new treatment that makes you live longer. It enhances your memory and makes you more creative. It makes you look more attractive.
That's right. It helps keep you slim and lowers food cravings.
It protects you from cancer and dementia. It wards off colds and the flu.
It lowers your risk of heart attack, strokes, not to mention diabetes. However, there are serious side effects, including feeling happier, less depressed, less anxious. Ah, but wait, there's more. The best part of this product,
it's free.
No shipping required.
So if you saw this ad, would you be interested in the product? Well, the problem is nobody's put out an ad like that. And according to Susan Harris and a number of researchers and the Centers for Disease Control, about a third of this country's population is not getting anywhere near the recommended amount of sleep. And Susan Harris says,
it's essentially another pandemic that we are experiencing,
which in its way is killing thousands of people every year. Next time, if you're still awake, we'll dive into what being sleep deprived can do to us. This is Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
What are the highlights of USDA's annual look at population and economic trends in rural America? Rod Bain tells us.
A positive trend in rural population growth of late.
The rural population has continued to grow since 2020. The Census Bureau data shows the rural growth of 0.25% from July 2020 through June of 2022.
USDA economic researcher Jim Davis, among the authors of the 2023 edition of the Rural America at a Glance report.
The Rural America at a Glance is an annual report, and it usually covers an annual summary of demographic and economic trends with additional topics that highlight current opportunities and challenges that are facing rural America.
So among the topics of focus within the annual report,
population, often poverty and employment, but then focuses and takes a dive into a particular topic of interest. This year's report is focusing on population and migration trends, poverty, housing insecurity, employment, and clean energy jobs.
The finding of a slight uptick in rural population growth of late is significant, according to Davis, as
this continues an important turnaround in population growth from the decade of 2010 to 2020, where annual growth rates were either negative or near zero.
As for the why behind the rise in rural population as a whole,
we found rural growth was due primarily to net domestic migration from urban to rural areas.
In terms of rural population changes versus urban population during the time period,
urban areas, there was domestic net out migration on net. However, urban areas also continued to grow due to international net migration into cities.
And regarding rural population change by region,
net domestic migration was strongest into rural areas that are in the upper west and also in the south, and that we still have some net domestic outmigration from the Midwest and the Corn Belt.
In total, Davis cites five main takeaways from this year's Rural America at a Glance report. In addition to the trend of increased rural population growth,
we also find that rural poverty has been modestly declining. A third, we find that housing insecurity continues to be a persistent issue, particularly for low-income households. Fourth, we find that rural employment has essentially recovered from the COVID-19 pandemic. And then finally, we look at rural clean energy jobs and find that 1% of jobs in rural America are in industries such as solar and biofuels.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Working to strengthen the future of agriculture. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. Agriculture Future of America and the National FFA Organization made their partnership official. The group signed a Memorandum of Understanding during AFA's leadership conference in November. The MOU cements the bond that existed between the two groups and underscores a shared commitment to developing and empowering the next generation of leaders. Scott Stump, CEO of the National FFA Organization, says AFA and FFA have similar goals and values regarding the role of school-based agriculture education. One of the primary objectives of the partnership is to create a seamless pathway for young individuals who are passionate about agriculture to transition from FFA to AFA. By doing so, they'll get access to a wide array of leadership development opportunities, scholarships, internships, membership programs, and job opportunities. FFA and AFA also intend to collaborate on various projects and initiatives that promote agriculture education and leadership, including the chance to interact with experienced professionals. This is the Agnet News Hour. We will return in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the Agnet News Hour. Today's interview segment comes from Chuck Zimmerman, who was at the National Association of Farm Broadcasting Annual Convention Trade Talk.
I'm visiting with Ron Lamberty with the American Coalition for Ethanol, and I think we'd like to talk a little bit about this vehicle. You kind of use the term HEF. What does that mean?
HEF is an abbreviation for Hybrid Electric Flex Fuel. And what it is it's a 2019 Ford Fusion Hybrid that we had converted using the converters that eFlexFuel.com sells, because primarily just to see what the carbon intensity would be. It was kind of that experience because, you know, when you see what EPA does with vehicles, you know, a standard car has emissions around 400 grams per mile. EPA assumes that a hybrid runs on batteries half the time, and so they assume a score of about, I think theirs with this vehicle right out of the box was 213 grams per mile. So we thought, how much more could you reduce that by putting flex fuel in there, which has a lower grams per mile score than gasoline, even though you're going to lose some mileage. So we thought, what the heck, we'll change, you know, convert a vehicle over, see what it does and report on it. Because at, you know, in 2019, a Tesla 3 national average-wise, they're total life cycle greenhouse gas emissions, which include the emissions you get from manufacturing electricity, was at about 140. They list it now at about 111, but now since we've run this vehicle for 2.25 years, our numbers are coming in probably in the high hundreds, 170, 180. But at the same time, there have been some studies done on electric vehicles, particularly the one that we sort of patterned this experiment after, where it was supposed to get range of 310 miles, and Road and Track did a 40,000-mile test that said it gets about 80 less than that, about 230 miles. So when you redivide theirs, their number comes up to about 150, 160. So it's comparable. And that was what we were trying to show. But on top of that, you know, even though we're getting lower mileage because the E85 price has been so much lower than gas, we've actually saved about $250 over that period of time. So it's been a good experiment, but it's sort of, you know, we just need to kind of knock some people on the head to realize that there are other options out there other than just let's go headlong full speed into plug-in electrics. And that's what the experiment's meant to do. And it's, you know, and it's showing that. I mean, cost-wise, it's a fraction, you know, less than half, probably about a third of what you'd pay for a you know, full electric vehicle. So, I mean, there's all kinds of advantages to it. And turns out we just found out recently we're not the only ones doing this. So,
I'm looking at a slide you had. There are other ones out there.
Yeah, we had we went to the Global Ethanol Conference, the U.S. Grains Council's meeting out in Reston, Virginia, D.C., basically, where they had people from all over the world. And then afterwards, various states hosted delegations, and we had one from Latin America. It was Guatemala, Panama, and I think it was Costa Rica. But yeah, so we had this group there, and the guy who was leading the group, you know, I was driving HEF, and he said, we stopped to talk about it, and I showed it to him, and he said, I got to send you something. He sent me these slides from a Brazilian auto show where Toyota is now marketing a hybrid electric flex fuel vehicles. Theirs is, they have HEV-FFV, so they've got extra Vs in there, but it's HEV. And that's been their philosophy. Toyota's been pretty consistent about electric vehicles, you know, saying things like we can make 10 hybrids using the same battery material we use in one EV. And, you know, then you take away range anxiety, which, you know, where you live, it's not as big a deal. But where I live and it gets cold in the winter, you know, even that 80-mile loss that was in the car and driver test, that's small compared to what people with EVs report in the, you know, the upper plains, I guess, during the winter. And, you know, if you can run on gas when you're not running on battery, and we're not plugging into anything, so it doesn't matter, like you get around St. Louis where, you know, they have a really high CI in their electricity, too, because it's still a lot of coal and fossil fuel-powered plants still. There I know my numbers would be lower than if I were charging my car by plugging into the wall in St. Louis. But, you know, it just makes sense to me. It's always made sense to me that hybrids have always made sense because if you're rolling down the road and you got wheels turning and brakes and all that other stuff that charges your battery, why not do that? And then when you're driving slow or driving around town, it's battery, it's not fuel. But then when you get to the point where there's fuel, let's use the cleanest fuel we have, and that's E85. And that's, you know, in Brazil, it's either fuel with a lot of ethanol or fuel that's just ethanol. It's like E27 or E100, basically, or 98. So, I mean, they're starting to sell it, and it'll be interesting to see what it does. And I'm interested. I mean, I'm hoping we can get them to, you know, maybe bring one up, and I'll just keep it, you know. but at least have
it. Because you're testing it.
Because I want to be for science. Not because I want to drive a special car. I just, you know, it's for science. But it's cool. It's one of those things that, you know, the fact that it made sense. It made sense to them, too, and they're smarter about it than I am. But it's kind of fun to be right, you know.
So what do you think in terms of the outlook for how this particular type of vehicle will become more commercialized?
I mean, it's a huge uphill fight because right now, basically, the people who say they're environmentalists are really lobbying for technology. They want to have electric vehicles. And it's like they trust that electricity will just keep getting cleaner and cleaner. But you tell them, you know, these farmers are using more sustainable practices, so your numbers aren't right for corn. And, you know, we can sequester carbon or reuse carbon. They're like, yeah, I don't know if that'll happen. But they are 100% convinced that we're going to be running on solar and wind within the next, whatever, 10 or 15 years, or at least 20 years. But, you know, we could do this right now. We could reduce emissions by so much right now, even if we just did kits, even if they didn't start remanufacturing stuff. These eflexfuel.com kits are, you know, you can put them on, I wouldn't say 90, I mean, I don't know what the percentage is, but you can go on, plug your car in, see if it would work. But that reduction, I mean, my vehicle, if it were a gas vehicle, would be putting out 400 grams of carbon per mile. Now it's doing 185. So do that to, I mean, half of the vehicles in the country, it would be 10% of the vehicles in the country. Such a huge drop compared to, you know, 111, I think, is what they say the average is for a Tesla 3 that still gets 310 mile, or, you know, miles per fill or per charge. You know, and there's a total of, I think, 2 million plug-in electrics on the road now. Even flex fuel vehicles, there's still 20 million plus that are out there. I mean, a lot of people don't know they have them. But as, you know, E85 is becoming a little more available every year, and the places where they sell it are doing really well with it, you see that price out there that's a buck cheaper than gas, people start saying, oh, that's what that yellow cap was for. So a lot of people who've had FFVs for a long time, you know, are finally realizing that they can use the stuff and they're being able to find it. So it's an uphill battle because I think, you know, a lot of legislators and people in, you know, EPA or whatever have sort of just given up on E85. But, you know, they gave up on electric once too. So, I mean, it hopefully we can make that comeback. But it just, to me, it makes so much more sense than a lot of the other things they're doing. And especially in you know, the parts of the world that I live in, you know, drive through, that have four seasons and long spaces between small cities. It just makes a lot of sense. I mean, electric cars make perfect sense if you're in a big city where, you know, you're taking short trips and you can charge a lot of places. But, you know, out on the northern plains, not so much. There's, you know, so, I hope they'll notice it. If they're looking for solutions, it's a great one. But if they're looking to just do if it's kind of myopic, which it seems to be right now, then we're still going to be battling. But we'll still fight the fight.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Ron Lamberty. I'm Chuck Zimmerman reporting. All righty.
This is the AgNet News Hour, and we will return in just a moment with more agriculture news. You're listening to the AgNet News Hour, and now to wrap up our show today, evaluating performance potential for dairy heifers, whether as members of the milking herd or candidates for raising beef on dairy calves, has never been more critical or accessible. Bob Severa has this report from Holstein USA.
The stakes are high when it comes to making dairy cattle breeding decisions. From rising input costs to a lucrative market for beef on dairy calves, each female requires careful consideration about her future in the herd. Dan Weigel of Zoetis reminds producers how genomic data can make an impact for dairies of all types and sizes.
Genomics are absolutely scale-free. Just raising heifers, the cost is high for everybody right now. If you're having to raise heifers, extra heifers, that means you're selling fewer of these beef calves. You want to maximize your profitability per cow.
When getting with either Clarified or Clarified Plus genomic tests from Zoetis, Weigel recommends focusing on pre-breeding heifers. Look back at performance records to analyze conception and pregnancy rates for both the current and previous generations. He asks the question, how many heifers do we want to make each year?
Heifers are actually selling for a very good money right now, so rather than continue to put the expensive feed into them, we can and cash those heifers in. And we really want to push people to use the information. Are you going to use sex semen? Are you going to make some beef cross calves? Because that really maximizes information. If we can work with you on those things.
Genomic data reveal important insights into where a female might best fit within the herd. But it's not just about immediate results.
I really challenge producers to not think about where they're at today, but what if they focus their efforts on their best animals? Would they perform better? And could this all be feasible, using more sex semen on their better animals? And again, most cases we find the answer is yes. This Holstein cow and heifer are much, much more fertile than they used to be, and we can get this done.
Results from Clarified Plus are calculated into the Dairy Wellness Profit Index, multi-trait selection that includes cow and calf wellness, production, fertility, functional type, longevity, livability, calving ability, and milk quality traits.
Continuous improvement is our mantra, so we'll continue to tweak that index and probably make it more personalized as we go forward for specific dairies.
Visit dairywellness.com to learn more about genomic testing from Zoetis. For Holstein Association USA, I'm Bob Cervera.
That's today's top agriculture news. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.